All right, John chapter 9. Here is recorded the sixth miracle of John's gospel, the seven major miracles. The seventh and final will be in chapter 11. And remember, that is beside his resurrection and then the appearance to the disciples after the matter. So chapter 9 records another healing, and it is again on the Sabbath, which caused a lot of questions and trouble from the Pharisees, namely. And we see, really, I think, a striking contrast between the growth of faith in this man who was healed of his blindness that he had from birth in chapter 9 and what we saw in chapter 8. Remember in chapter 8 and verse 30, it says they believed in him as he spoke. Many believed in him. And he challenged their belief with what true discipleship is. And that caused them, as he spoke about their bondage and sin, to question him a little further. And you can kind of see their faith that they started to have in verse 30 deteriorate to the point where eventually they took up stones to throw at him and kill him. And here you've kind of got the opposite of that with this man who is healed and he has a measure of faith, if you will, and expresses that when he obviously is healed and he gives Jesus the credit, verse 11. But then when he's taken to the Pharisees because there's going to be a question about whether Jesus broke the law of Moses, as was the question in chapter 5 when he healed a man at the pool of Bethesda on the Sabbath, questioned him, and you can see his faith grow throughout this process. And it's a very impressive demonstration of the whole purpose of John's gospel, and that is the miracles of Jesus are written that we may believe that he is the Christ, the Son of God, and believing we may have life in his name. And that's what Jesus will end the chapter with when he comes back to this man after he is ultimately persecuted and castigated by the Pharisees and the Jewish rulers, and seeks him out a little further to help him grow in his faith a little more and come to the understanding of who Jesus really is and all the implications of what had just happened with him and the healing of his blindness. And then he will profess that Jesus is the Son of God. And so that's just a mere summary, but this is going to, again, you might think of it in this way, it makes it a little more powerful, I think, if we keep it in context. With chapter 8 going right into chapter 9 from unbelief, and that starting with some measure of faith and deteriorating to unbelief, and then starting with some measure of faith and increasing to greater faith and confession of who Jesus is. And it doesn't have anything to do with the difference in Jesus' words or the actions Jesus has performed thus far miraculously. It just has to do with the heart and whether they want the truth or they don't. Are there any comments, questions before we get into this chapter? Maybe from chapter 8 or just something you had that came up in your study. All right. So chapter 9 in verses 1 through 12, it says, as Jesus passed by, he saw a man who was blind from birth. And his disciples asked him, saying, Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? Jesus answered, neither this man nor his parents sinned, but that the works of God should be revealed in him. I must work the works of him who sent me while it is day. The night is coming when no one can work. As long as I am in the world, I am the light of the world. You might notice at the end of chapter 8, it says, after they took up stones to throw at him, he hid himself and went out of the temple, going through the midst of them, and so passed by. And then verse 1 says, as Jesus passed by. And so that has led some to believe that this is happening immediately after. But that's not necessarily the case. You think about the situation as Jesus passed by at the end of chapter 8. He's escaping for his life, whether that's miraculously or he just walked through them and they weren't able to take him for whatever reason. He escaped death at that time. You know, maybe it doesn't add up as much that he would stop and be speaking to this man at such a tense time, but that's really beside the point. What we do know, as we've studied previously in chapter 7 at the Feast of Tabernacles, that Jesus is within the last 6 months of his ministry before he's going to die on the cross. And so things are elevating, and they're by no means getting better. And so here Jesus being in Jerusalem, and coming by this man, sees an opportunity, knowing it's the Sabbath, and even though things are tense, and his time is drawing near because of how much his relationship with the Jews has deteriorated, he still works the works of God, even though he knew what it would provoke in those people. And so he passes by, he sees a blind man, and notice he's blind from birth, and the disciples ask an interesting question. Who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? Jesus answers, neither one, but that the works of God should be revealed. But there is something that we can address in regard to that. What reason was given by Jesus that the man was born blind, that the works of God be revealed in him? That was number one, so I answered that. But the research question, or the thought question rather, says, explain how sometimes troubles in this life are the direct result of sin, whereas other times they are not. Jesus is saying it wasn't a direct result of sin. But are there times where physical affliction is a direct result from sin? And give an example, like what? Maybe a specific example of a character in the Bible, or just a general example.
A person who drinks all the time winds up with a bad liver. That's a direct
result. Right. I think that's especially what we see today. That's an excellent example. You know, you drink alcohol, it has its effects, negative to the body. You take drugs, same thing. You know, those who are promiscuous, Romans 1 points out that those unnatural sexual acts and then, you know, just premarital sex on top of that is something that is not within God's will, and there are physical negative effects that come with that. Romans 1 kind of brings that out with the Gentiles. That they received in themselves the penalty of their error, which was due. And so certainly, sin has its consequences. It doesn't always lead to physical affliction, but a lot of times it certainly does. But what about in the case of like this blind man? When you have a situation where the question is, did he sin or his parents? There was a traditional view that the Jews held that was erring, that you could sin in the womb and because of your sin be punished in regards to that. That's more Calvinistic and Catholic in thought than biblical. So obviously some of the Jews were erring, and it might have been that that's what his disciples thought erringly enough, but maybe they thought that. They did ask, you know, they had a conclusion, either this man sinned or his parents, who was it? If his parents sinned, that means that he's being punished because of his parents' sins. If he sinned, he was born blind, so he must have done it before he was born. And so both of those were wrong at this occasion. But we do see in Israelite history where the sin of the fathers was visited on the sons. Not the guilt, mind you. Ezekiel 18 says that's not something that's possible. The sinner is guilty, not the progeny of his, of the sinner, not those of his posterity. But that is not something which negates the possibility of your own kinsmen or, you know, successive generations suffering because of something you did. David is an example of that. The sword would not depart from his house when he sinned with Bathsheba. His son actually died, not because of his son's sin, but because of his sin. And so there were answers to that under the Old Testament. Whether that happens today or not, I can't say. I don't know what God's doing and what he's not doing. One thing we can know, though, is that regardless of what the reason for that affliction is, sometimes, like with Shirley's example, you can know, why'd you get liver disease? Well, you've been drinking, and it happens. But maybe something bad happens, and you can't, you know, find the reason for it, and maybe it's not that God's chastening you, like Hebrews 12 says. But when bad things happen, what does God expect us to do? How does he expect us to take it?
Be patient.
Be patient. So get some growth from it. James 2, count it all joy. We won't always be able to tell why, and that's not a question that we're supposed to answer. That's up to God. But what we can do is, in any given situation, use it for our good. Grow patience. and grow spiritually in regard to that. Focus on the spiritual things. Maybe give some time to self-reflection to see if there is something amiss in your life. Regardless of what that is, we need to use it for our good and address it positively.
And man's not exempt from pain and suffering and sorrows. It affects all of it. One time or another, even though there's not sin involved.
Yeah, well, then that is ultimately the cause of sin. It goes back to the beginning. Mm-hmm. And so suffering and death in whatever form is because of sin, at least indirectly from sin coming into the world and corrupting it. So at least we always need to understand that it's applied of all men and we need to respond appropriately. That's kind of a side point, though, because what did Jesus say was the reason this man was born blind? Right, so he could work miracles, and that's what he's saying. John never uses miracle, he says works, the works of God, and they are miracles. Now, what this isn't saying is that God caused this man to be born blind so that Jesus could work this miracle at this point in his life. I think what Jesus is saying very clearly with what he says in verses 4 and 5 is that this is just an opportunity for me. I see something that I can do good with. I see a situation where I can carry on the work of my Father. And so he said, I must work the works of him who sent me while it is day. The night is coming when no man can work or no one can work. As long as I'm in the world, I'm the light of the world. And so what is he talking about? Night is coming for himself. What does he mean by the night's coming? Where he's not going to be able to do these miracles anymore.
Death on the cross.
Yeah, when he dies on the cross. 3 days he's going to be in the tomb, but then when he's raised from the dead, while we'll see some miracles he performs in front of his disciples, you know, other than obviously the biggest miracle, his resurrection, that's going to be an end of his time. That's why John is writing this. He doesn't have to stay on earth and perform miracles over and over and over again. Those will be done through his apostles, but his miracles are recorded so that we can read and have faith. John 20, 30, and 32, and 31 and 32. So that's what he's saying. I'm sent here to do this and manifest the glory of God. John 1, 14, in his incarnation, we beheld his glory, the glory of God, full of grace and truth. And so he's going to take advantage of this opportunity because that's his purpose. He's the light of the world. Now, there's a connection with this. You know, as I mentioned, some will like to look at the miracles and draw some points out of each miracle as an object lesson, like when he turned the water to wine, that was power over quality. When he fed the 5,000 with 5 loaves of bread and 2 fish, that was his power over quantity. And so I think those are some pretty legitimate lessons to learn from that. Someone will say in John 9, this is his power over darkness display. And that's certainly the case. A man never seeing at all is all of a sudden having the light enter his eyes and be reflected in whatever, however the eye works and he can see. But more than that is the spiritual application of this. Never forget that these miracles, although they achieved something wondrous physically for that person and changed this man's life, the reason he did them was spiritually. And it'll be capped off with that in this chapter and tying it back to what Jesus says, I'm the light of the world. The light of the world that he explained himself to be in John 1 was no physical light. He didn't come to cure blindness. It was spiritual light. And this would ultimately point that out for this man and bring him to saving faith, the faith in Christ. And so how did he heal this man? What was done to restore his sight is question number 2.
He spat on the ground, made clay, and put it on his eyes, and had him go wash in the pool of Siloam.
Right, kind of makes this recoil a little bit, right? He spits in the dirt, kneads it into some clay, puts it on his eyes, and tells him to go wash in the pool of Siloam. So he went and washed. So similar almost to the thought of what might happen in John 5 with the people going to the pool of Bethesda and being healed, yet Jesus says, get up and walk. He sends him to a pool to wash. And he came back seeing. And so, very straightforward how Jesus healed him. It certainly wasn't that the spit or the dirt had any healing qualities in them. So how can we explain how it worked?
He obeyed.
That's exactly the point. Jesus has the authority. He is the creator, and so he has power over the creation, which includes this man's body. So when he told him, do this and this, and the man did it, then he was healed. What's some spiritual application we can learn from that? How could we use that when we teach people?
He did what he was asked without question.
Yeah, he didn't hesitate. He did what he was asked without question. Yeah, baptism. So what about it? You got to do it, right? It's a command. And there's nothing spiritually powerful within the water itself. We're baptized all the time. When we swim, when we take a bath, we're immersed, right? But baptism in the name of Christ, that is by his authority for the remission of sins, is obeying the words of Jesus. And since he has the authority, just like this man's blindness was immediately relieved whenever he did exactly what Jesus says, immediately when we're baptized, our sins are washed away. Mark 2 is something that I like to think about a lot when we're talking about miracles and their ultimate purpose. When Jesus healed the paralytic, and before he healed him, he said, your sins are forgiven you, and that made a big fuss with the Pharisees. So he said, so that you may know the Son of Man has power on earth to forgive sins, take up your bed and walk, and he did. He performed that miracle. At his word, the miracle was performed, which means he has authority there. And if he has authority there, then he has authority to say, your sins are forgiven you, and they're forgiven you. And he says our sins are forgiven us when we obey. And so this is a case study of how God works with man. If you do what he says, and he promises that when you do what he says, you will be forgiven or healed or made his child, then that's exactly what happens. So if you stop short, even if it's a step short, or if you go beyond what he says and say, but you got to do this too, like the Judaizing teacher, you got to be circumcised, then you're not going to be forgiven. You won't be a child of God. It's as simple as that. It's the formula God gives, which will take effect and be effective. And so you've got to fulfill it. And it's not earning. It was still Jesus' power that did this. So after that happened, and he came back seeing, evidently Jesus wasn't there. Because here's this question with others. Is this the one who sat and begged? Some were saying it is him. Some were saying he's like him. He said, I am he. And then they asked, how were your eyes open? He didn't point, this man did it. He said, a man called Jesus made clay and anointed my eyes and said to me, go to the pool of Siloam and wash. So I went and washed and received sight. So they said to him, where is he? And he said, I do not know. So the important point I want to make here is to notice this is the start of the process of the man's faith. He didn't say the Messiah healed me. He didn't say the Son of God healed me. He didn't even say a prophet healed me. He's about to when they start questioning him. He said a man called Jesus did this. He has no question that that's what happened. Evidently, Jesus revealed his name to him. And so he knows, he made that connection. I couldn't see, never could ever in my life. This man told me to do this and then I could see. I'm giving credit to him. There's no question in my mind that Jesus healed me. And so he's starting to process his faith. What we need to remember is that faith is something about reason. It is, in Hebrews 11 and verse 1, called substance and evidence. In Acts 26 and 25, you might remember Paul said that he speaks the words of truth and reason. Faith is reasonable. And this is going to be demonstrated with this man, where he is following sound logic, and by following sound logic is growing faith. And will eventually believe fully, without a doubt, that this man Jesus is the Son of God. And then the Pharisees are mixing things up. They're contradicting themselves. They're defying logic. They're being inconsistent. And it's all because they're biased and they don't love the truth and they don't want the truth. And so it's like Jesus said in John 8:37, my word has no place in you. You only let it come this far and then you don't like what you hear, so you cut it off. Well, this man is honest. He wants it all. And he's going to let the truth take him wherever the truth takes him. And the Pharisees are going to resist it ultimately. So they brought him who was formerly blind to the Pharisees. And it was the Sabbath when Jesus made the clay and opened his eyes. Remember the same thing in chapter 5? It was the Sabbath. This is actually one of seven times Jesus healed on the Sabbath day. Jesus is not ignorant about their tradition. And so it leads me to believe that Jesus knows this and he wants to expose their error and he wants to try to bring some of them out to the light. That's what light does. It exposes darkness so that those in the darkness can come out of it and come to the light. And so he chose. He could have waited, couldn't he have? This man's been blind all his life. Why not just wait till tomorrow? Well, it's because he knew what this would cause. So it's the Sabbath day. Now, this really is an unimportant point, but I read that part of the Mishnah, which is their traditions, one of the specific things, in addition to what it mentions about what happened in chapter 5, that you can't even pick up a bed and walk on the Sabbath day. That's in the Mishnah, and that's probably what led to the events of John 5 when he healed that man on the Sabbath. But that if you need anything, so for instance, dough or clay made from spit and dirt, and so he needed this. He mashed it together and put it on this man's eyes. So he worked on the Sabbath. He broke what they believed was the law, which was really just tradition. He didn't break the law. He's not a sinner. And so these people, knowing that, it doesn't expose what their hearts were, like they wanted to get Jesus in trouble or this man in trouble. But here's a dilemma. And who deals with spiritual dilemmas? Pharisees, right? The Sanhedrin Council, the scribes. So let's go to them about this question. And so the Pharisees asked him, that man, verse 15, how he had received his sight. He said to them, he put clay in my eyes and I washed and I see. He didn't add to it, he didn't take away from it. Just in the simplest way possible, he explained what happened. Now notice, they don't refute the miracle. Verse 16 doesn't say they question it. Now verse 18 said they won't believe that he's blind until they ask his parents. But they're not questioning this. A crowd brought the man to them who knew him as one who's born blind. So they're not questioning the validity of this man was blind and now he sees. They're just asking who did it and how did it happen. And he put it very simply. Now, question four is what reasonings caused division among the Pharisees? So there were two different conclusions they reached that caused division. What were they? It's in verse 16.
Doing it on the Sabbath, and some said he was a sinner, and some
thank you, Jesus, to being a sinner.
Well, some accused him as a sinner. He healed on the Sabbath. That's sin. We know it's sin, so he sinned. He's a sinner. And then the other said, what? If he was a sinner, how'd he do these things? So there's division. Now, the second group, I don't think, is necessarily willing to go as far as their logic would take them if they followed it. But they did reason that his actions don't really equate to him being a sinner. And so the logical conclusion to that is that maybe we need to revisit our interpretation of the Sabbath law. Because if what we say is he sinned by doing what he did, but then he performed this miracle on the Sabbath, that means God's with him. How could a sinner do this? And so it must be that we're wrong on that side of things. Now, they didn't reach that, but that is the logical conclusion. But those are the two conclusions. He's not from God because he broke the Sabbath, and if he was a sinner, how did he do such a sign? And remember in chapter 7, after they wanted to kill him because he healed a man on the Sabbath in chapter 5, he brought that up again in chapter 7 and said, because I did one work, you seek to kill me. And he showed them why they were wrong in their thinking by the example of circumcision. We're commanded to circumcise, and if the man is to be circumcised or the baby is 8 days old on the Sabbath, then he's going to be circumcised. And y'all understand that's okay, so obviously there's something wrong with your interpretation of the law. Instead of judging according to appearance, judge with righteous judgment. Maybe they're thinking about his words there. And so they're not as quick to condemn him. They're maybe thinking, well, he did just perform a miracle. No man can work miracles who's a sinner. Only people who are with God can work miracles. And so, you know, maybe there's something we're not seeing here. So there's a division among them. Now, what's interesting is that in verse 17, who do they turn to ask about what the conclusion should be?
Blind man.
Is he a scribe? Is he a lawyer? Is he studious in the word or in the schools? No, he's just a beggar. And they still turn to him and say, what about you? What do you think about this? How did he open your eyes? Or what does it you say about him because he opened your eyes? So here's you know, the order of events. He tells them how he was healed. They reason among themselves, and no doubt there's more words than just these two sentences. They're trying to reason with each other and figure out what it is that happened. And one group is sounding pretty logical in their thinking. There's no way that he sinned if he performed a miracle, because God is performing that miracle, and that's obvious. This is not deniable, and so our only conclusion is he can't be a sinner. Don't know who he is. Don't know what conclusions we're going to reach, but he can't be a sinner if he does such things. And so him hearing that, he's starting to reason as well. He's starting to think a little bit. And he goes from this man, Jesus, to a prophet. He's a prophet. So he's reaching a different level of faith. Now, it's going to continue to progress, but he went from a man called Jesus to a prophet. He's letting the truth take him where the truth is wanting to take him. Not so much for the other set of Pharisees. In verse 18, the Jews did not believe concerning him that he had been blind and received his sight until they called the parents of him who had received his sight. And they asked them, saying, "Is this your son who you say was born blind? How then does he now see?" So essentially three questions. One that's kind of joined together, is this your son who was born blind? They're asking, is he your son? Was he indeed born blind? And if he was born blind, then how does he see? Now they answer the first two questions, but how could they answer the third question? They weren't there. They may have heard some things, but as we'll see in verse 22 and 24 or 23, they're not going to venture that far because they know what could happen if they suggest this man Jesus healed him. So this is what they say. "We know that this is our son," there's answer to number one, "and that he was born blind, but we do not know by what means he now sees or who opened his eyes. He is of age, ask him, he will speak for himself." So here's two things. The Pharisees, they don't want to believe it, so they're going to find a hole in this. He wasn't really born blind. His parents denied it, so it couldn't have been that this miracle was performed. But while they can't say how it happened, the parents of all people know that he was born blind. Quite obviously, you would know if your baby's blind, and you would know if your toddler's blind, and you would know if your teenager and teenager and adult son is blind. And they knew he was blind. He's never seen before at all. And so they're kind of running into a wall here. And the reason they didn't answer that third question is why. Why did his parents fear the Jews? They feared him, so they didn't answer. But why did they fear the Jews? Verse 22.
They put out the temple.
Right. Remember in chapter 7 at the Feast of Tabernacles when Jesus came in a little after the feast started, that there was, by the text of John 7, quite obviously some news that had gone about in Jerusalem regarding the conspiracies of the Sanhedrin against Jesus, and they knew they were seeking to kill him. And so evidently, part of that is that they had warned everyone, if you confess that he's the Christ, you are going to be excommunicated from the synagogue, the place of worship. You can't be a part of the worship of your nation and the one and only true God if you confess this man as the Christ. And so they weren't going to say a thing. And they really couldn't say a thing at all. All they could probably say is what they had heard about what happened, but they weren't eyewitnesses by any means. They didn't have any firsthand knowledge. So his parents said, "He is of age, ask him." So in verse 24, they turn back to the man and question him further. This is powerful, I think, because here's a simple man and some very studied scribes and Pharisees. The scribes were of the Pharisees, that's why I say that. And he's just following the truth and logic, and they're making a fool of themselves. And he pretty much calls them on it. And that's the difference between a heart that desires truth and a heart that really doesn't want truth. Even if something is quite obviously illogical and unreasonable, they will see it and think that it is logical and reasonable because they don't want to see the truth. And it doesn't matter how smart a person is, if they don't want the truth, they're not going to be able to understand the truth. I think that's been very apparent throughout the Gospel of John, and it is throughout the entirety of the Gospels. That's why Jesus spoke in parables. So that seeing they will not see and hearing they will not hear. Because he wants those who truly desire the truth. So, verse 24 says, "They again called for the man who was blind and said to him, 'Give God the glory. We know that this man is a sinner.'" And Joshua 7:19, when Achan had sinned by taking the accursed things of Jericho and they failed to beat Ai because of that, Joshua said, "Give God the glory." Speak truthfully is what he was saying there in that text. And I think that's what they're saying here. Own up and tell the truth. Listen, you know the truth, so stop denying it. Tell us. And so I think it kind of seems like they're trying to force him into a false confession of sorts. They're kind of applying the pressure to him. Give God the glory, even though he has been. He's been giving Jesus the glory. So we know this man is a sinner. Well, that's not really knowledge they actually have. That's just what they suppose, because he healed a man on the Sabbath. Now, this is his answer. Well, how did he answer? We know this man is a sinner. That's number 6. Verse 25. But what is he then? Yeah. Who out of anybody of the Jews would know that a certain act was a sin? I mean, all Jews should have known, but who would they go to?
Pharisees.
Hey, you know the law. So listen, whether he's a sinner or not, hey, that's your realm. You know, you're the experts of the law. I don't know whether he's a sinner. But what I can speak on is firsthand, I was blind, have been my whole life. And now I see. And it was because of this man. And so their logic is not sticking. Jesus didn't break that law. But he says it's not for me to decide. So verse 26, they continue with the questioning. They said to him again, what did he do to you? How did he open your eyes? If you've got a person who asks a question and they're told the truth and it's verified, and they ask the same question, what does that usually indicate? They don't really want the truth. They don't believe you. They don't like what they heard. Maybe this time it'll be different. We're kind of foolish sometimes in that. We don't like what we heard, so we'll ask again. Maybe we'll hear a different answer. That's not the case. So they're showing their dishonesty, and he's kind of growing tired of it, because look at his response in verse 27. I told you already, and you did not listen. What, do you want to hear it again? Do you also want to become his disciples? That's kind of a bold move, isn't it? That shows the power of the truth, in my estimation. This man knows what happened. He knows that he's right and they're wrong. He knows that what he's thinking is truth, regardless of what they're accusing Jesus of and what they'll go on to accuse him of. And so he kind of sarcastically asks, if you're so, you know, inquisitive about this, you must want to be his disciple. That offended them. So why did they claim? So what did they say in verse 28 and 29? You are his disciples, but we are Moses' disciples. We know that God spoke to Moses. As for this fellow, we do not know where he is from. So number 7 is, why did they claim to be the disciple of Moses instead of Jesus? What did they say?
They're disciples of Moses.
We don't want to be Jesus' disciples. We're disciples of Moses. And it's because we know God spoke with Moses. We know God's relationship with Moses. That's quite obvious under the law recorded. We don't know where this man is from. Now, it's not that they don't know where he's from physically or any kind of thing. They're just kind of, they're throwing all the facts and all the information out to act as if there is nothing to back up these claims of Jesus, when in fact, there is a ton, and that's what people who don't love the truth will do. They'll throw it all out as if we haven't given any evidence at all. How could this be if it doesn't fit with my way of thinking? Here's a good question. How did the children of Israel, not even just in reading the Old Testament, the people at this time, way back when the Exodus first started, in Exodus 3, how did the children of Israel know Moses was sent by God?
He done miracles.
Exactly. He did miracles. How would they know Jesus is a man sent by God? He just healed a man. And so they're being inconsistent with their own thinking and their own understanding of the law. We know Moses spoke with God. How? Well, from the very beginning, it was because of the miracles he performed. He had the rod of God, and he threw it down and it turned into a snake, grabbed it up again, put your hand in your bosom and it'll be withered, and put it back in and it'll be whole, or make this water into blood, all these kinds of things. Moses verified that he was a man sent from God and had authority because of the miracles he performed. And that is exactly the purpose of miracles throughout the entirety of the Bible. And it's no different here. And so they're not even following their own logic. And this man calls them on it. Wait a second, he says in verse 30. Why, this is a marvelous thing that you do not know where he is from. Yet he has opened my eyes. That's such a simple statement. But that's the power of the truth. It's not complex. It's simple. If you just want to know it and understand it, you can. I know that he opened my eyes. Now we know that God does not hear sinners, but if anyone is a worshiper of God and does his will, he hears him. Since the world began, it has been unheard of that anyone opened the eyes of one who is born blind. If this man were not from God, he could do nothing. He uses what is called in logical argument a syllogism. And it's just successive points which logically follow each other. So firstly, he opened my eyes. And we know that a sinner doesn't have God with him to hear those prayers and work those miracles. And not only did he open my eyes, but I was born blind, and there's not been any kind of miracle ever recorded in the entire history of our nation of such a thing. So it's not just a miracle, it's an outstanding miracle, even though all miracles are outstanding. So his conclusion from that is, if this man were not from God, he could do nothing. In other words, he is from God. Why? Because he healed me of my blindness. Notice his faith growing. It started from, this man Jesus told me to wash, and I was able to see. Oh, he must be a prophet. And now he is adamant and being challenged by the authority of the Jews that, listen, this argument is airtight. You cannot convince me otherwise. So, research question. Where does the Bible teach God heareth not sinners? Is that a truth?
Yeah, yes.
It is a truth. And it's not because this man said it inherently, he's not inspired, but it's because the Bible makes it very clear. For instance, Isaiah 59, 1 through 2. Your iniquities have separated you from your God, and shortened his hand that he cannot heal, and his ear that he cannot hear. The book gave Psalm 66, 18, Proverbs 28, 9, and 15, and 29. And there's several other passages which we could turn to demonstrate if you're in sin and you're not repentant of that sin, you're not a child of God, God doesn't hear your prayers. It's a privilege of the saints, and it's a privilege of those saints who are walking in truth. So that's a research question, just as a side point. So they answered and said to him, in verse 34, you were completely born in sins, and are you teaching us? And they cast him out. That is so telling, because what did they not believe earlier on? They had to go to his parents to find out whether that was true.
They didn't believe he was blind.
Yeah. There was no evidence whatsoever, no indication that the miracle was fraudulent. They didn't really challenge it. They thought, okay, I'm going to find a hole in this. Maybe he wasn't really born blind, so they had doubts about that. Now why are they all of a sudden so sure about it? Why are they so adamant that he was born blind? That actually refutes their claims. You were born in sin, and I think that's why I'm saying that. They were affirming he was born blind because they were thinking the same way in verse 2 that the disciples were thinking. He was born in sins, that's why he's born blind. So you were born in sins, and you're teaching us? You're born blind. Wait, you can see now. That kind of defeats my point. But that's what error does. It doesn't think straight. And when it's challenged, it can't stand up to the truth. 2 Corinthians 10 says that the weapons are mighty in God for pulling down strongholds and casting down every argument and things that exalt itself against the knowledge of God. That they have nowhere to go, so they're just going to kind of, you know, throw out these things and murky the waters. And so what they really do as elitists, they kind of look down on him in arrogance and say, who are you to reason with us? He was showing himself to be the logical one, not them. But they're offended at that.
You notice, too, anytime a person's in truth and somebody's in error trying to, they can't prove that what they're saying is true, so they'll attack the person. They don't use any kind of love.
Yeah.
They'll just attack the person.
You see that a lot. That's a great point. They just attack the person. So so all these things are making sense. We can't answer them. So who are you to tell us, right? You're just a big old dummy. You're a sinner. And so that kind of is proof in the pudding that they were wrong in their position. So they cast him out. And so in verse 35, Jesus heard they cast him out, found him, and said to him, do you believe in the Son of God? So when the Bible says, seek and you will find, knock and it will be open to you, here is a case study of that. If you want to know the truth, and you're searching for it, you're trying to navigate and find it and stuff, you're going to need help. God has told us. We can't figure it out all on our own. That's why he revealed to us the gospel. Will he help? Will we find? Will it be open to us? Absolutely. And here's a case study of it. Jesus sought him out. listen, I heard about this man's challenging the rulers and standing up for what he knew was right and truth. And so I'm going to see how far he'll let his faith take him. And so he said, "Do you believe in the Son of God?" He said, "Who is he, Lord, that I may believe in him?" And Jesus said to him, "You have both seen him, and it is he who is talking with you." And he said, "Lord, I believe." And he worshiped him. So notice again his faith growing. Did he see Jesus back before this?
No.
No. All implications would lead to the conclusion that he didn't, because he was blind. He was told to go heal. He came back seeing, and the man wasn't there. He knew his name, evidently. And maybe even he remembered his voice. And I think that would be what explains when he says, "Who is he, Lord, that I may believe in him?" Why would I believe that he is who you point him out to be? Well, it's because you're the one that healed me, and you must be a prophet from God. He already reasoned that. And so when he says, "You have both seen him," you're seeing me right now, "and it is he who is talking with you." Remember my voice back there, and I'm talking with you here? Make that connection. I'm the Son of God. Now, that's a pretty bold claim. That's a drastic claim. And it was perhaps unheard of to this man. Son of God in the flesh? How could this man be the Son of God? But he didn't deny it. He was strengthened in faith because everything else added up. It was an outstanding claim, an incredible claim, an unheard of claim perhaps, but it wasn't baseless. And that's kind of what we studied at the very beginning in our introduction, is that this book does not, reason for us. It gives us the facts, and we have to be the ones who reason with it and think about it and reach the most logical conclusion. And the most logical conclusion is that he is the Son of God. So Jesus said, "For judgment I have come into this world, that those who do not see may see, and that those who see may be blind or made blind." And some of the Pharisees who were with him heard these words and said to him, "Are we blind also?" And Jesus said to them, "If you were blind, you would have no sin. But now you say we see, therefore your sin remains." We have to be quick on this. But remember when he said back in chapter 9 and verse 9, "As long as I'm in the world, I'm the light of the world," and how he's going to tie that together with the spiritual realities that are shown in these miracles and the whole purpose behind them. That's what he's saying here. He's not talking about he came to heal men of their blindness. He's saying this man sees, yeah, physically, but he was blind spiritually before. Now he sees spiritually. He sees the Son of God. "And also those, so that those who do see may become blind." And the Pharisees are wondering if he thinks they're the blind ones. And he explains, "If you were blind, you would have no sin. But now you say we see, therefore your sin remains." They don't truly see. They think they see. They think they're better than these things. They think they know better. There's no way that this man is the Son of God. We know better than that. But because they're arrogant and they're not willing to yield to the facts, they're actually made blind. And so if they were just humble, in other words, and realize the facts, and then reach the conclusion that maybe I didn't know, maybe I was erring, even with their tradition on the Sabbath law, maybe I'm wrong on this, then they would come to the light of the true knowledge of God and of his word and of the Son of God. But because they were arrogant, they didn't love the truth, they were made blind. And because of that, their sin remains, because like chapter 8 said, you don't believe in me, you'll die in your sins. They don't believe in Jesus, there's no way out of their sins. And since they're made blind by their own arrogance, then they're not going to be forgiven. That's chapter 9. Any comments or questions on that? Well, that was kind of fast. Next Wednesday is our singing night. And then the Wednesday after that, we'll start with chapter 10 and probably think about some of the things in chapter 9 too, because it connects.